Thank you, David. So yeah, I'm very happy that you flew back to attend the talk. I promise I didn't light up the fire because would have been a good reason, but not quite as good. So yes, I want to tell you about a problem which is really a problem which is in computer science information theory. And let me just give you a very short idea of the problem. Imagine that you have somewhere a source of information, and it broadcasts this information, and it broadcasts it along a tree. So you have a certain message. This message is sent here, 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 here. It's broadcast everywhere. And these are noisy channels. Now, you look at this, at the leaves of the tree, and you receive only the signals which are here. And the question that is asked in this problem is whether you can reconstruct, whether you have some information about what was sent or not, in the limit in which you have a very large depth. So if I have a tree of depth L, I will ask whether there is some information contained in the messages on the leaves about what has been sent. So you can, I mean, this is a, so it's a formal mathematical problem of information theory, very basic. In some sense, you can see it as a natural generalization of the simple Markov chain. You know very well that if you have just a line instead of a tree, and you ask the same question, and if you have noisy channels here, well, the information decays exponentially. The joint information between the point and the source decays exponentially with distance. So the answer will be that in the large L limit for a chain, you have no information. You lose the information. Now, the question, of course, if you have a tree instead of a chain, you have many more messages up there, and you can use that maybe to reconstruct what was sent. So it's a problem that has appeared in several contexts, in communication networks. It has to do with the propagation of genetic information. It also has to do with problems of glasses, and this is probably not obvious to start with, but I will tell you why later on in this talk. So let me be maybe a little bit more precise and introduce some notation. So a communication channel like that. So imagine that, first of all, the message, I will say that the message I will take for simplicity, I'm all describing the thing in the simplest possible case, because, I mean, you can do it with the irregular trees, you can do it with, there are a lot of variations on this topic. But here I will take a message which is just a color among Q colors, let's say. And then I have a channel, and I will keep two simple channels in which the probability, if you have color X and Y, the probability of having Y given that you have sent X is given by 1 minus epsilon if Y equal X, and epsilon over Q minus 1 if Y is different from X. So it's a simple channel which just with certain probability it is faithful, and with the other with probability epsilon it will choose a completely different color uniformly among all the others. So let me also be more precise about what I mean by reconstruction. So reconstruction I need some kind of measure of reconstruction. So I will introduce one notation, which is boundary here. B will be the configuration of the leaves, all the messages that have, all the colors that have been received on the leaves. So I have two process really. I have a process which is a process of broadcast. So the broadcast, what it does, it will generate a boundary given a certain initial message. So X0 will be the message on the source here. And so the broadcast generates a boundary. And then I have the reconstruction. And the reconstruction so this one I should call it PB and PR. And PR, what it will aim at doing, it will aim at finding what is the value of X0 given a certain boundary. that is in the reconstruction, what I am given, I am now given the boundary, and I want to try to infer what is the most probable value of the variable on the source. And so a measure of whether reconstruction is possible or not, always in this kind of simple setting here, is simply to look at the probability of, imagine that I have sent x0 equal 1. Okay. Then I will look at the probability of reconstruction times the probability of broadcast summed over the boundary. So let me say again what it is. What I am doing here, I am broadcasting from a certain letter x0 equal 1. This generates a certain boundary, certain probability. I will average over all this boundary the reconstruction probability. So now this thing, I have to compare it to 1 over q, which would be when there is no signal at all, if I have just uniform distribution of all colors, and then I have no color. So this thing here, it depends on the depth of the tree, and my question about reconstruction is whether the limit when L goes to infinity of psi L is strictly positive or not. If it is strictly positive, one says that reconstruction is possible. If it is zero, reconstruction is impossible. So again, this is just one possible measure. You can also use measures in terms of mutual information and so on and so forth, but the content is always the same. So now the thing which is nice in this problem is that I will show you actually that when you study this problem, there is a phase transition. And so the phase transition depends on the level of noise. Epsilon is a measure of the noise. Larger epsilon, the more noisy the channel. And so there is a threshold, epsilon r, such that for epsilon larger than epsilon r, reconstruction is impossible, while below epsilon r, reconstruction is possible. And there has been quite some interest in trying to understand what is this phase transition in computer science, and I will try to explain you a little bit how one can study that also using physical methods. So first of all, just to show you the phase transition, I will derive the simple upper bound. And the upper bound is the following. It amounts to saying, well, imagine that I have started with color 1. The most favorable case would be the case in which the boundary happens to be all 1s. This may happen with low probability, but of course, this is the most polarized boundary that I can have. So let us try to study what happens in this case. So the thing that one has to do is study a little bit the reconstruction, that is trying to understand how you go from the information now on the boundary to information on the next layer, on the next layer, on the next layer. You do that, of course, recursively. So what you can do is imagine that you have just, I take a tree with bifurcation 2. So I have x1, and I will assume that x1 has a certain probability eta 1 of x1, which is due to what comes up to the leaves on this branch of the tree, and eta 2 of x2 here. And this one I will call it x. And now I can, by summing over x1 and x2, I can have a certain mapping, which will be eta of x. And let me write it explicitly. Eta of x, I write it as some normalization constant times the sum doing here, I'm doing the following thing. I'm supposing that I know the probability of x1 due to the top of the tree. Same for x2. And then I try to infer what is the probability on x. And that's self-explanatory. That is, I multiply the probability of X1 by the probability of the channel, and I get something. So this is a recursion that I can use to infer for the reconstruction from the top. So you can use this thing starting from a boundary, which would be everybody on the boundary. The boundary is a sure result. And what you find is, so I will not write explicitly all the equations, but they are simple to write. The flow is simply written in terms of a level n. Eta n of x can be written as 1 minus an. It has, of course, a symmetry. That is, it has a certain value for the column number 1 and a symmetry for all the other colors. And this mapping here tells you that you find a mapping which gives what is an minus 1 as a function of an. You can write this mapping, plot it, and you look at what happens. And what happens is the following. There is a fixed point at q minus 1 over q, and this fixed point, it means it's a message which is 1 over q, 1 over q, 1 over q, so it contains no information. And then the mapping takes two different forms depending on the value of epsilon. Either it can be like this, or it can be like that. So in the white case, which is the case where epsilon is less than a certain threshold, then you have a fixed point, an attractive fixed point starting from 1. You go to this fixed point here. It contains information, so reconstruction is possible. Otherwise, it is not. So what you find from and the value of epsilon f, it turned out it's q minus 1 over q, k minus 1 over k. So I skip the details, but that's some very elementary computation. So what this tells is really a bound, because it tells us what happens if we start from some boundary which would be very favorable. And it means that if we are above epsilon f, above this number, certainly reconstruction will always be impossible. Okay, because even if you had a plus boundary condition, you don't get a plus one at the root.
So independent of statistic of noise, or
here I am just keeping this analysis was all done for this channel here. Everything I will give you some more general result later on, but I mean just to explain, I want to keep to the simplest channel.
Did you say what K was?
Oh, sorry, I should. K is the branching. The number of branches here. And it could be generalized to arbitrary Galtung-Watson trees and so on.
This is something like localization.
It has, it's more like kind of percolation. That is, you want to understand what is there a percolating branch of ones? If you start with one, will there be a percolating branch of one going up to the top in some sense? That's some. Okay, so that's the.
And this is effectively infinite dimension limit.
It's on a tree. That's if you want. Yeah, it's a localization on a tree, so it means that it has some kind of infinite dimensional flavor in it. And in fact, it will be related to glass theory in infinite dimension. Okay, let me show you now something which is slightly more subtle, which is a lower bound. And this lower bound goes back to Kesten and Stigum in 1966. So it's a problem which has received some attention for a long time, a very natural problem in some sense. And the idea of this lower bound is the following. Instead of looking at all the details of the configuration of the boundary, we will focus on the census. So the census will be to say, look at all the variables which are in the boundary, and look at how many xi are value 1, how many xi have value 2, etc. You don't look at where they are. You just look at how many of them there are. You do the census. And this contains less information than the full boundary condition because you have left aside the structure, the spatial structure due to the tree. And so now, if you can reconstruct with the senses, a fortiori you can reconstruct in general. So how is it? How can you analyze this problem of census reconstruction? Well, I will not do the full mathematics, but I will give you the main idea. So imagine that you look at the shell number L, number n. So you have k to the n variables, and imagine that Rn among them are equal to 1. Okay. So now let us try to understand what is the value of Rn plus 1. So let us see what happens in the next shell. So in the next shell, what you have is the following. Let me first write it and then explain. You will look first at the Rn times k to the n variables which are equal to 1. And some of them will broadcast a 1, some of them will broadcast somebody else. So it means that this variable ui, it takes value 1 with probability 1 minus epsilon, and 0 with probability epsilon. So 1 means I had a variable which was equal to 1, it has broadcast a 1. That happens with probability 1 minus epsilon. All the other cases are not favorable. They don't generate. Now this variable vi, it is equal to 1 with probability epsilon over q minus 1, and to 0 with probability 1 minus epsilon over q minus 1. And so what does it mean? This is what happens when you start from a variable which has a wrong color. Of course, by chance, it can generate a 1. And this chance is epsilon over q minus 1. All the other cases are unfavorable. Okay, so you look at this mapping. So you see that Rn plus 1 is a sum of a lot of terms here. And the first thing that you can look at is you can look at the expectation value. And looking at the expectation value, you find some recursion for the expectation value of Rn, and you find easily the expectation value of Rn. It behaves like 1 over q plus a certain constant, 1 minus epsilon q over q minus 1 to the n. This is easy. You just take this equation and you take the expectation value. You find that it is a geometric series up to a shift. And you reconstruct the thing here. Now you can look at the variance. And the variance of Rn, it is clear, because it's a sum of something which goes like k to the n terms, it is clear that the variance has to be k to the minus n over 2. Okay? So now you are in the following situation. If you look at the probability of Rn, see, you have 1 over q. 1 over q would be the case in which you have no information. And what you get is you have a sum of a lot of terms, so you get a Gaussian distribution. The Gaussian distribution is like that. It has a variance which goes like k to the minus n over 2. And the distance to 1 over q, which is this famous 1 minus epsilon q over q minus 1 to the n. So you could say, okay, the mean goes to 1 over q, so you will lose the information. But of course, it all depends on how it goes to the, which one is fastest. Does it go to 1 over q with the width which shrinks faster or not than the speed in which it goes to there? And so you get a threshold by comparing the width and the way in which it appears. And this threshold is called the Kesten-Stegen threshold, obviously. And epsilon ks in this case is q minus 1 over q, square root of k minus 1 over square root of k, just. And so what happens is that for epsilon less than this number, when the noise is less than that, well, the speed of approaching 1 over q is slow enough that you can get the census reconstruction. The reconstruction is possible. Census reconstruction is possible, and therefore reconstruction is possible. And for epsilon larger than epsilon ks, it is not. So here I have derived for you two bounds. So in some sense, what we get now as function of epsilon, we have the following situation. We have the Kestenstegen threshold. We have the simple, well, I call it ferromagnetic threshold, upper bound. And what we know is that here you can census reconstruct. And somewhere here, there will be the epsilon r that we are seeking, which will be the truth threshold for reconstruction. And now, one of the main... So this will be the real reconstruction. And so this is very nice. And so it is some old work. It has been studied in quite some details. Let me just tell you one thing which is interesting, which is how this generalizes to arbitrary channels, just the results. But I think you got the ideas. So imagine that you have a general channel pi of y given x. So if you look at this matrix, it has one eigenvalue which is equal to 1. And if you look at the second largest eigenvalue in modulus, so let me call it lambda 2 of pi, the second largest eigenvalue, it is such, so you have the two thresholds are such that the epsilon f is related to, is characterized by k times lambda 2 is equal to 1, and epsilon Kestenstegen is related to k square modulus of lambda 2 is equal to 1. So this is, if you want, this is some kind of instability property. I mean, you are looking at some kind of local instability, and you determine the threshold for local instabilities by using that. And now the main question that has been very fascinating for a lot of people has been to ask whether it can be the case that is epsilon r larger than epsilon Kestenstegen or not? That means really, can we gain information by looking at all the details of which variable has what variable has what color up there, or is all the information contained in the census? And the information, the result on that we quote a few results and some of the names. So a lot of work has been done by our colleagues, mathematicians, in particular by Mossel and Perez, have written a nice paper around 2002, several papers. And so one of the results that they have obtained is that for q equal 2, then you have epsilon r epsilon ks. And for large enough q, epsilon r is strictly larger than epsilon ks. Okay, so that's one of the results. And in a recent time, we have studied this problem with Andrea Montanari, who is in Stanford. And with Montanari, we have found some more precise values and so on, which probably they would not accept as new results, in the sense that they are not theorems, but they are just true, correct, whatever you want to call them. And so what we know is that for q equal 2, 3, 4, epsilon r is equal to epsilon ks, and for q larger or equal to 5, then reconstruction is different from census reconstruction. And we also have provided an efficient numerical way to compute all these thresholds, epsilon r, epsilon ks is explicit, but we have an efficient way of computing epsilon r numerically, so we can get it with a precision that we like. And also, one thing that I should have mentioned in the context here, there is another problem which is really very close to all what I have been saying now. You can look exactly at the problem that I've been looking at now, but with epsilon larger than q minus 1 over q. Imagine, so far, I was looking at a case in which epsilon is between 0 and q minus 1 over q, because q minus 1 over q is a case in which I have no information in the channel. the broadcast is uniform 1 over Q, so of course I lose immediately all the information, that's clear. Now if I go beyond that point, what it means is that if I have color 1, I transfer color 2 or 3, let's say if I have Q equals 3, with higher probability than 1. So this is also a channel, so that is the first case that we have studied so far, I call it ferromagnetic for obvious reason. And then for epsilon belonging to Q minus 1 over Q 1, we have the anti-ferromagnetic channel. In particular, for epsilon equal 1, it's a problem of coloring, because it's really the problem of coloring a graph, if here a tree, in the sense that if I have a color on one vertex, then I have to transmit someone which is a different color from the one that I had so far. And you can ask exactly the same question I have been asking so far. Does the coloring on the boundary contain information on the coloring on the inside? And so you get the same result, and of course, the method that we have been developing with Andrea Montanari also works in this case, and we can have all the thresholds and so on. It turns out that for the anti-ferromagnetic case, what happens is that for Q larger or equal to 4, and K larger or equal to a certain critical value, K star of Q, then we have... It's not epsilon now. It's, let me call it TR larger than TK, yes. Of course, here it's here the larger the epsilon, the less noisy is the channel. So T is a measure of the temperature, so it would be 1 minus epsilon in this case. So here there is some trick, because you see, even if I have epsilon equal 1 means that I'm sending a color different from the one that I had before. I'm not sure to be able to reconstruct like that. It's without noise, but I'm not. And so I need to have enough branching. I have not said, of course, all the conditions are that if K is large enough, there is a trade-off between the noise and K. If K is very large, you get more information. So here there is a critical value of K and this is a critical value of K for proper color rings that have been discussed. So now I would like to spend a few minutes to explain you why we really got interested into this problem and why we could make progress. And this has to do with the last part of my title, which was about glasses. So I will take 3 minutes to tell you some of the issues, current issues in glass theory. So you know that if you cool fast enough a system, it will enter any system, it will enter a glass phase. And the glass phase is not very well characterized. It's more a dynamical problem if you look at it experimentally. Basically, it's characterized by the following. If you look at a certain relaxation time of your system measured by a viscosity, viscosity is a product of a relaxation time times some stiffness constants. So you look at the relaxation time, and basically if the relaxation time becomes larger than 1 hour, you say your system is a glass. So this hour is defined because you are human and you are, I don't know, you are your students, your postdocs, yourself, and so on. So that's the definition. I'm sorry about it, but that's how it goes. Now, if you look at data of viscosity or plot it in terms of relaxation time, what is very spectacular is that there is, as a function of temperature, for instance, there is a certain category of systems, a broad category of systems, which are called fragile glasses, in which the relaxation time, it increases very rapidly when you decrease temperature. So this, by definition, is just the glass quotation mark transition temperature. And if you look, for instance, at around 3/2 of TG, then you will find something which could be typically 10 to the minus 13 R or something like that. So the glass transition, even if it is not very well defined, it is still not so bad of a definition in the sense that this thing is diverging so fast that any kind of definition that you will get will change a tiny bit the value of TG, but from an experimental point of view, I mean, yeah, there are very important theoretical issues around that. I mean, is there a transition or not? But from an experimental point of view, it does not matter so much. So, and it is known that in some systems, then people have tried to fit that, and there are various fits available in the literature depending on the system and so on. A popular one is that the relaxation time maybe goes like C over T minus a certain critical temperature. Another possibility would be that it goes like e to the c prime over t squared or something like that. This would hint at the fact that there is a true divergence at a finite temperature, and this would say that there is no true divergence and there are big, big fights and so on, and I don't want to enter that. But what it tells you is that so there is this very rapid increase, and one thing that people have been searching is really, is there a cooperative effect or not? I mean, what is responsible for this increase? And in particular, one thing that has not been clear at all for many, many years, and it's starting to get slightly clearer, although we are still far from the end, is whether there is an increasing static correlation length. First of all, if you look at a glass and you look at the pair correlation function, so the pair correlation function is the usual one that you define in liquids. You say that you have a particle, you take a particle at the origin and you look what is the probability that there is another particle at distance r. It will look something like that, g of r. And you find that it behaves very much like in a normal liquid. I mean, you know that when the temperature decreases, these peaks become a bit higher and so on, but there is nothing really spectacular going on in this G of R. It's just that of a liquid. So in some sense, a glass is a liquid which does not flow. That's a kind of tautology, but that's what you see from this pair correlation function. So now people have started to try to find out, in order to explain this very rapid increase, if there is an increasing correlation length. And most of the attempts have been finding some dynamic correlation length, but more recently, there has been some activity to try to find a static correlation length, and that's what I want to explain you. In particular, there has been a proposal by Biroli and Bouchot, which is the following, and it's something that they have implemented not in experiments but in numerical simulations. So what they look at, they take a glass former, something which with particles which interact with some kind of Lennard-Jones potential, and you put a little bit of disorder in the interaction so that it does not crystallize. So and then you look at the particles and you imagine that you generate a well-equilibrated configuration of particles at a certain temperature. So it will look something like that. And now you do the following trick. You look at one particle and you draw a ball of radius r around this particle, and you freeze everybody which is outside of this ball. And you generate inside the ball a new configuration. So you had a first configuration, equilibrated configuration. Let me call it C1. Then from C1, I keep the thing which was in the outside, I freeze it, and I generate a new interior, which I call C2. And now what you can look at is look in the center, around the center where you had the particle, and you can ask, are there some correlation between C1 and C2? Is there a particle in the center of C2 or not? And this you will do in the large R limit. So this is a kind of new object. It's a new way of defining the correlation function. It's not like a pair object. It's not like a point-to-point correlation that we usually use. It's what is called a point-to-set correlation. And this point-to-set correlation, in some theories of glasses, it is predicted that it will allow to define a static correlation length which diverges. And in fact, what they have seen in recent numerical work is something which tells you that some measure of the correlation, I don't enter the details, does something like this. So this is a function of R. And this is what happens when you decrease the temperature. So what you find is that at a given temperature, if R becomes large enough, you lose the correlation. You lose, I mean, the fact that you have, you see what I'm, imagine that you can do it with hard spheres, for instance. You freeze the hard sphere there, and you want to put some another configuration of hard spheres in the interior. Question, will the hard sphere in the center be located really in the center, or it will be anywhere? And the answer is like that. If R becomes large enough, you lose the correlation. But this kind of critical value of R, I can define a certain level of correlation, which allows you to get the R of the point-to-set correlation. And this typical size of correlation increases when the temperature decreases. And that has been something that has...
R is fixed as you change the temperature or what?
No. You do the experiment with various values. At each temperature, this first curve here is at one given temperature, let's say.
Yeah, but you have two R's, the radius of the sphere and the RPS.
No. I fix one temperature, and I measure the correlation for various values of R. I find this curve here. Okay. At another temperature, I find this other curve, and so on. And it has this kind of shape with a plateau, and then it decays. And so, because it does not decay exponentially with distance, but it's more like something with a plateau. So you have to find one way, so you can either fit the curves and so on, but you have to find one way of finding a characteristic scale. And okay, you can cut the correlation at one value and get the correlation. Well, the absolute value of the correlation, it does not matter very much, but the thing which matters is that you can see something which increases. And it's actually the first time, as far as I know, that people have really found a really increasing correlation length in glasses. And the nice step in doing that was jumping from pair correlation to point-to-set correlation. So now let me try to make contact with what I have said in the first part of the talk.
Is it sort of like averaging the pair correlation over a sphere?
No. It's not exactly the same thing. It's not exactly the same thing, because here again, you see what they are doing is really they are looking at the correlation between a point in the center and the full configuration on the boundary. It means all the particles which are here on the surface. So it's not exactly the same object. So in fact, one way to make a very close contact is to look at some model systems of glasses which we had studied for other reasons, which have to do with error-correcting codes in information theory and so on, which are glassy systems on random graphs. So that. So sorry, it's a third topic, but it will bridge the other two. So that's my excuse for introducing three different topics. So imagine that you have a random graph and you take the coloring problem. That's the extreme case. So you want to color a random graph in such a way that whenever there is an edge between two vertices, the colors at the end point of the edge are distinct. And you could do that on a random regular graph in order to make direct contact with what I had done there. You can do it much more generally. A random regular graph of degree k plus 1 is a graph which is a random graph where each vertex has exactly degree k plus 1. And so imagine that you you generate a graph complete with uniform measure among all the sets of graph which have this property of having a good a fixed degree k plus 1.
But it has loops.
It has loops, but it turns out that if you look at this problem, the loops are long, typically. Because basically, imagine here I have degree 3, so one way of building such a graph would be to start from this guy, decide who are his neighbors. There are 3 points. Then who are the neighbors of the neighbors? Neighbor of the neighbors, there are 2 square times 3 points taken among n with probability 1. They are not the same. And so when do you have loops? You have loops when you go to a depth which is of order log n. So the typical size of loops in such system is of order log n. N is the number of points in vertices in the graph, sorry. So what it means is that this is not a good drawing. Actually, the good drawing is really this one. Etc., etc., and somewhere there will be some loops. Actually, there will be quite a lot of loops, but of long size. So it means, so this is a problem, which is a problem that has been studied quite a lot. This is an interesting problem because, on one hand, it has this structure that is called locally tree-like. For obvious reasons. On the other hand, it has loops, and the loops can generate some frustration in the problem. So I have all the good ingredients to make a glass or a spin glass or whatever type of glass I like to study, without relying. So it will be a glass which has, locally it looks like a tree, but it has the loops. That's much better than what had in the 80s and so on, some colleagues. Several people had studied systems on trees like that, and studied the spin glass problem on the tree. Spin glass problem on the tree is very badly defined, because in some sense, if you have really a tree, the frustration comes in only through the way you put the boundary condition. And more or less half of the spins are on the boundary, so you are putting by hand the situation of half of your system, and so it's a very bad situation. What is much better is to study these problems here, because you don't need to put anything. So I can look at the coloring. That's something that it's a problem in computer science that has its own life and story, which is coloring random graph. So you can ask what happens if you want to color a random graph like that. And what you see is that you have exactly a problem with, let's say, Q colors. So you have variables xi, which are in one Q. And you can ask what is the property of such a system. Now, it happens that this is what we knew, and that's how we made contact with the broadcast and reconstruction problem. It happens that there are different situations depending on the value of Q and the branching number K plus 1. So here K plus 1 is the degree of the graph because in my broadcast I had K branches, but I had a special root. So you could see that as some kind of system in which I have cut one edge and I'm looking at one branch of the tree. And so what we know is that depending on the value of Q and of K, there are different situations. And the situation that happens is that there are two different types of glass transition that can happen. It may happen that the glass transition is second order or first order. And to measure that, one way to do it is to look at the correlation function between 2 points on the graph. So I look at the point I and the point J, and I look at the pair correlation. So technically, it would be something like connected correlation function, let's say. So this is an object that tells me if I change the color, it's a linear response object. If I change the color here, what is the probability that I change the color there? And I can look, of course, at something which is sum over J, what is called the spin glass susceptibility, which is sum of the j of kij square, it tells me if I change the color in I, what is the global effect everywhere? Does it have some impact or not? And that's, so there are some if there is a second order transition, it's signaled by a divergence of this susceptibility. But what we knew from our study of this problem of the coloring problem, we knew that there are other cases. There are cases in which you have a glass transition in your problem, which is not signaled by the divergence of this object here. But it is signaled by what? Well, by just the point-to-set correlation. So you can define another object, which is a point-to-set correlation. Exactly in the same way as I was doing here for my particles, that is, I take one variable, I look at all the variables at a certain distance r, I freeze the outside, I look at the correlation. Exactly the same thing. So this defines me a certain length scale, r point to set. And it may happen that there is a first order phase transition in which I have the point to set characteristic length which goes to infinity while the susceptibility remains finite. Now, one thing which is not obvious and which I will not explain during the talk, but I can explain to those who are interested afterwards, is that the second order transition is exactly the same thing as the Kesten-Stegum transition in the broadcast reconstruction problem. Well, this is exactly what I was calling the reconstruction threshold. It's not obvious because what it tells me something which is really not obvious at all and that I have still not completely understood, I must say, but nobody has yet understood it completely. It tells me something that if I look at this random graph, so imagine that I have this large random graph, I cut a sphere with a large radius r. And I look at what is, and then the rest of the thing creates some boundary condition on this sphere. This boundary condition created by the exterior will have the same statistical properties as the one that I have in my broadcast problem starting from the root. This is not obvious, and I mean, okay, you have to believe me and take my word for it. We can show it by looking at the equations to solve both of the two problems, let's say, and finding an identity. There is a mapping between the two problems at the level of the equations. But I don't have a very good intuitive ideas of why it is so. And that's something which is still missing. But I think it's something which is very interesting because, I mean, at least from the point of view of the glass physics, it gives something which is very nice. Because, as I told you, the attempts to define a glass problem on a tree, they were kind of naive. Most of the attempts were saying, look, I will take a coloring problem, I will, let's say, color the points on the boundary here with randomly, completely randomly independently, and I will look at the problem of coloring the tree. This is not at all a good glass model. The good glass model, it must have, I mean, at least the one that corresponds to the problem that you have on the random graph, it must have some correlated boundary condition, and the correlated boundary condition must take into account the fact that these two points, they are neighbors to the same one. And that's what we have in structural glasses, and that's what we have here. So I'm sorry that it is the where my intuition stops and I cannot go much beyond that. And then, of course, for people who are more interested, I can show them at least the structure of the equations that lead to that. But I think that probably I should stop here.
And this is independent of the P of the possible.
So whether there is a second order or first order transition, it depends on the two parameters, the Q, I call it Q, this one, the Q colors, and the K, which is the degree of the graph. And you have exactly the same, because they now it turned out that they are the same thresholds, so you have the same tables of thresholds and so on that I had before. And the numerical way of finding the reconstruction threshold that I have told you, it has been directly borrowed from the numerical method that we have developed for glasses and random graphs. So that's, I think that's the story.
So when you said you can map this random graph problem back to your original tree, so it means that these large loops don't matter so much?
No. The large loops matter a lot because, I mean, if they were not here, I would have no frustration at all and my problem would not have a glass transition. So what is really very non-trivial is that the large loops, they matter. They create a boundary condition here, which is very complicated, which has some correlation. What we know is that it is certainly not independent random variables on the boundary. And the correlation that are created by the rest of the graph with the long loops are statistically equivalent to the correlation that are generated by a broadcast starting from the root. Not WDMBS at all.
Like log n?
No, n goes to infinity first and r goes to infinity afterwards because I want to have something which is... So locally tree-like means that, yeah, all this is done in the very large n limit where log n is very large.
R is sort of... The maximum R you can get to is a order log n, right?
Yes. But I'm doing an asymptotic analysis at very large n, at very large log n. Well, you may say that it's not valid, but on the other hand, one thing that I should say is that using exactly the same technique, you build algorithms for graph coloring. Yeah. And these algorithms, they are the best algorithms for these problems. No, nobody knows better algorithm than that. So it's efficient also for finite n, for n equal 10,000.
I mean, you don't start seeing the loops till you get near the boundary.
Well, in this problem here, you should not think in terms of boundary because it's a random graph. But
look at your R where you define this point to set correlation. Until I get the R of order log n,
yes.
I don't see effects of loops.
Yes. But my problem, I have a measure on the coloring of the graphs, and these guys here, they are connected to a lot of other, so they have their own measure due to the exterior. And this measure due to the exterior, it has some correlation due to the very long loops. It turns out that this correlation, they have the same statistical structure as the one that are generated if I broadcast from a root. That's a fact. It's not obvious.
But do you think this will survive in finite dimension?
Well, I think the thing that's something which is very... I mean, finite dimension is... No, the answer is no. The answer is no because, of course, here there is something which is very special, that the number of variables which are on the boundary grows exponentially with the distance. Well, of course, it will grow like a polynomial in finite dimension. Still, you can have, on a certain length scale, you can have the same kind of physics, and that's what these guys, our colleagues, are looking at. I mean, if they would be able to do this experiment at much lower temperature on a very, very long length scale, probably it will cross over to something different, because at some point they will see that the thing does not grow exponentially. The surface does not grow like the volume in some sense. But what it means is that really, if one would be able to measure at very, very low temperature, one would see, I'm convinced that one would see some signal on the two-point correlations. Because the thing that is reflected by the point two set will have some impact on the two-point correlation because the number of points on the boundary does not grow that fast. But it turns out that numerically and so on, nobody has been able to see anything on the two-point correlation. It would mean going to very, very low temperature and nobody is able to thermalize. So this seems to be a good way of doing things.
Is the functional form of these boundary conditions as a function of tree distance known, or is that kind of uniform, or...
The function form is known and it does not depend on the depth of the cavity that you do. But I have the functional form, yes.
You've told us about dependence on these integer parameters, q and k, for, like, for instance, your epsilons and the nature of transitions. I'm wondering about the possibility that q and k don't have to be integers, because sometimes when you rewrite these models in other variables, that restriction disappears.
Yes, you're absolutely right. So one thing, the thing that has been studied a lot is the case in which k is not an integer, but let's take an Erdős-Reni graph instead of a random regular graph. Then you can vary the average degree. The role of k will be played by the average degree of a vertex, the connectivity of the graph, and this you can vary it continuously very easily. Varying q continuously would be very interesting, and that's appealing from the point of view of physicists working on POTS variables, but I don't know how to do it.
That occurs, you know, in the Castellan Fortnow expansion.
Yes, I know that, but still, in this context, nobody has been really able to use it and to make predictions for intermediate values of Q. I know how to define in principle the model with arbitrary Q. Now the question is how you do it, how you use it in practice. Are you able to give me some phase diagram?
When you found these transitions that depended on the values of Q, you had some analytic model, I assume. And I was wondering whether the transitions occurred at integer values or somewhere in between.
No, the transitions occurs... here really the thing... I mean, for K I can interpolate very easily, but for Q we are working only with integers. And so what we can say is for a given integer, is reconstruction possible or not? And then I say, okay, it has occurred some value of Q between the two integers, but I don't know where it is. And that would be interesting, but nobody knows really how to generalize a phase diagram. I know how to generalize the model, but...
One solves the POTS model on a tree, not by the beta approximation, but with recursion, which is the correct method. One sees a series of phase transitions, right, rather than a single one. I'm wondering whether those series of phase transitions are related to the different epsilons that you found.
Well, first of all, the better method that we use here is exactly the recursion on the tree. The only difference is what you do with boundary conditions. I mean, usual models of usual approaches to solving POTS model on tree, they start from typically IID boundary condition with some kind of distribution, and then write some recursion from one external shell to the next, and so on. And here, in some sense, if you want to solve with this method, the better approach, you solve this problem, but with self-consistently defined boundary conditions. That's the main difference. So I think it's not really the same problem, because boundary conditions matter a lot.
My question was for the ferromagnetic POTS model on the initial tree, not on the Erdős-Rényi graph.
Yes.
There are a series of phase transitions, and whether those can be related to your epsilons.
But what boundary condition do you want to study?
Just put a magnetic field on the boundary.
Yes.
And then you'll find that the average magnetization, the variance of magnetization, etc., they become singular at different...
Yes, but no, this will not be related to my epsilon r and so on. It's much more related. So one extreme case of what you say is that you put an infinite magnetic field on the boundary, and then you get back to my upper bound that I was showing at the beginning with this ferromagnetic upper bound. And so it's more in this kind of thing that... but. My real problem, the real problem of broadcasters and reconstruction, is different from that, because I want to generate this configuration from broadcast, and it means that it will necessarily be frustrating. It will be frustrating. So that's why it's related to the blast transition in the end. That is, the broadcast generates a certain type of boundary condition, which is frustrating.